Welcome to the junior year episode 9 of the Horror Podcast. My name is Tyler and I'm the editor-in-chief of Signal Horizon and a teacher at a local high school here in Kansas City, Missouri. Signal Horizon is the go-to place for smart genre programming. For all of our coverage, check out signalhorizon.com. I'm joined tonight by our co-host and book editor of Signal Horizon, Mike. What's the news, Mike?
Oh, not a whole lot. Not a whole lot, Tyler. I just started a new job, but nobody wants to hear about that because that's boring. People want to hear about our guests that we got tonight. Tonight, we've got Bram Stoker Award-winning author Nicole Cushing, who you've heard me talk about over and over again. And we've got horror actor John Amplis as well. Isn't that crazy cool?
Crazy talk, I tell you.
I know. It is crazy. John, how about we start with John? John, how are you doing tonight?
Well, very well, thanks.
We are excited to have you on here in this kind of first segment. We talk about any kind of movies or books or projects that we've seen that we are excited about. Is there anything recently that you saw that you thought was outstanding or anything that...
Oh, that I saw myself? Yeah. Well, the latest Tarantino movie, I think, was my son and I went, I guess, when it first came out. What the heck's the name of it?
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood,
there
right?
You have it. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Yep. Very good. I loved it. So that's the last thing I saw. I'm looking forward to The Irishman
coming out.
Oh, yeah,
that's great.
Yeah, and geez, that's about all the movies I've seen in the theater. I watch a lot of TV, though. That's because I retired a year ago.
Is there
ago.
A TV show that you like that you're super oh, into?
I'm looking at everything. I'm trying to find everything I can. I've gone back through HBO and looked at some of all of those guys, Sopranos, and I looked back and saw watched Breaking Bad again, and I think we're in the golden age of TV, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, there is a ton of stuff out there, almost
too. There is, and
totally agree. You know, it's great that unlike all of my relatives who are retired, you're not just sitting around watching Fox News on TV.
Fox is not my stuff. Channel.
That's good. Yeah, and I think you'll find a home here. So
Good. Nobody I know watches Fox.
Yeah, so. That's about where we're at. Hey, Nicole. Do you watch Fox? And if not, what are you excited about? Yay!
I do not watch Fox, but what I'm excited about over the weekend, I went to see the Texas Chainsaw Massacre at a drive-in, won an original film print.
Awesome!
We have this great place here in Indiana called the Georgetown Drive-In. And I was just blown away. I mean, when you see these films on the big screen, there is just something that you really get out of it that you would not get on your home TV. So over the years, I've seen like Night of the Living Dead. I've seen that at the Georgetown Drive-In on an original film print. Saw the original Halloween on original film print there. So there's just all kinds of Christine is another one I saw there. All kinds of great stuff.
This convention I'm going to at Cinema Wasteland in Strongville, Ohio. I'm assuming maybe you guys have heard of it, maybe not.
I have, yeah.
It's been going on for about, I don't know how many years, 16, 17, 18. But it kind of specializes in drive-in movies and stuff. That's how it kind of got it started, the two people that run it.
I've heard good things about that convention for years.
they're terrific people. And, you know, they kind of started this whole thing out from selling drive-in posters and things of that nature. And so this little, well, it's not so little. It's always full. Convention is terrific. I've been to it several times. But this weekend coming, we're going to have the first Martin reunion.
That's awesome.
It was made 43 years ago. Suddenly,
time to get
we finally got a reunion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that.
About time.
Well, I think that conversation about the return of that, you know, kind of specific drive-in theaters. We have a couple of like old-timey movie theaters that now have a lot of free screenings. They've become more like communal spaces for people to hang out. And at least with ours, they tend to be centered around genre programming. That brings out the people that really like, you know, to see the theater. So.
Yeah, for sure.
So, Mike, what do you got going on? What are you interested in this week?
Well, you sent me a movie that's been going around the film circuit called Violence Voyager.
Yeah.
And boy, that was a thing. Holy moly. Nicole, have you heard of this? Have you heard of this thing, Violence Voyager?
No, but I don't watch a whole lot of movies made after 1979.
Oh, all right then. Okay. So here it is, right? It's Japanese. It's kind of animated, but not really. They're cutouts, paper cutouts that are put against a static background and then moved around. It has just the weirdest feel to it. I still don't know what I thought about this movie, but it definitely had an effect. What effect, I'm not sure, but it had an effect. And actually, it gets back to some of the really early, like that's kind of where Japanese animation came from, is this like this post-war paper puppets. I think that's really interesting. But boy, it was just the weirdest darn horror movie I'd ever seen in a while.
The style is actually called Gekimation, which is where they use a gazillion paper cutouts, almost like stop motion. It's very odd, but it was all over the kind of the buzz at Fantastic Fest. So I finally got somebody here to take a look at because it's interesting.
Nicole, you've got a couple of books out right now. I'd love to hear how things are going with your two new books.
Well, thank you. Well, I have two books, like you said, that are out this season, essentially. One is my new novel called A Sick Gray Laugh, and that came out on August 27th from Word Horde. And it's kind of a difficult to describe, really. There's a great review that was done up on Signal Horizon by Scott Kemper that I, folks can kind of check out. But you know, sort of the horror of madness and of history and of cults and all that kind of good stuff. And so using some techniques that I haven't used before in fiction. So I'm really excited about that. It took a long time to write, but I'm really thrilled about it. And then the other book, which is coming out in November, early November, I think I want to say the 14th, but I could be wrong about that, is a novella called The Half Freaks. And that was made available as a limited hardcover edition that sold out very quickly, sold out within 24 hours. Working with Grimmscribe Press. And so the hardcover edition has these lovely, surreal illustrations by a gentleman named Harry O. Morris, who was actually the first publisher of Thomas Ligotti's work. He was the publisher behind Silver Scarab Press, who originally published Songs of a Dead Dreamer back in the 80s. And he's just kind of a legendary figure in small press horror. So having his involvement in that was really cool. And then, of course, it'll also be available as a trade paperback and an ebook starting in November. So excited about both of those projects. It's good to have stuff out after
lots
not having anything new out
stuff,
for a few
years. To check out, man. It's pretty darn awesome.
Thank you.
Yep. And so we've got a, like you said, we've got a review for A Sick Gray Laugh on Signal Horizon. There'll be a link in the show notes, as well as a link to my review of the upcoming Half Freaks, which I really liked. Yeah. And I just missed out on getting that limited hardcover. I just missed out. So I'll probably have to just really take it in the nose to go get it on the secondhand market, but we'll see. We'll see. I don't think so. I don't think so. All right. So usually we do a Dark Corners of the Web this week, which is where our viewers can go find some free horror content on the internet. And of course, since we're going to be talking about John Romero's movie, Martin.
Yeah, what's you that? Put both of Did us I say together. John? That's okay. That puts me in good company.
All right. Holy moly. I'm tired. I drink another cup of coffee here. So, yeah, Tyler, what do we have for this week on
so
Dark
this
Corners
is really
of the
very
Web?
Simple. We are about to start spooky season. As we are recording this, it's September 30th. So, that being said, the quintessential Halloween movie from the quintessential master would be Night of the Living Dead. You can, and we encourage you to buy the digitally remastered, really crisp, really beautiful Blu-rays of Night of the Living Dead. But because of the way that the movie was copyrighted, anybody can check it out right now on YouTube. So if you haven't seen it, watch it for the first time there, and then go spend some money on a beautiful, wonderful, digitally remastered copy. Like, there's a Criterion collection out of that movie now that it's almost like watching a fundamentally different film. So Night of the Living Dead is my favorite. It should be your favorite, too. Trundle on over to YouTube and check out Night of the Living Dead.
Very cool.
Awesome. So this week we're going to be talking about the movie Martin. And we got onto this subject because I really wanted to have Nicole on the podcast. And I said, you know, usually we talk about a movie. Why don't we, what kind of movies are you into? And then she told me, and then of course I forgot that she doesn't watch movies made after about 1974. So we kind of batted around a couple of things. And I said, you know, one of the things that I really like to do is, get a movie that kind of matches with somebody's written work, right? And Nicole does a lot of really, really great stuff in her fiction. But one of the things that I've noticed that she does that almost nobody else can get right is really get the kind of blue-collar horror, the blue-collar nature of things. And there's a couple of short stories where she does that really, really well, a couple of longer works where she really knocks it out. And I said, do you know any good kind of like, blue collar horror? And the first thing she said was Martin. And that's
our
how
essential
this,
question
that's
of the week
born.
Is what can the
so Tyler, what is our essential
Martin
question
tell
of the
us
week?
About vampires and socio-political class structure? So that's a mouthful.
Oh, wow.
That's holy moly. Stuff. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I can tell you that. So, whatever you think about Martin, whether he is or isn't, I mean, he does take blood, but there's nothing traditional there, and it doesn't reference back in any way except in the minds of Cuda and poor Martins, I guess, to any kind of gothic backstory. It really debunks. It kind of debunks the old and the new. You know, the old set against the new in many ways. Also, the deterioration, you know, of society when we shot Martin, it was 1976. And at that time, especially Braddock, which is a small town right next to Pittsburgh, part of Pittsburgh, really. But it was a industrial town. It was a mill town. And during that time, you know, Pittsburgh was going through a real loss of industry. Steel mills were closing. Towns were people in small towns were out of work. Pittsburgh's on a river system, so all of our mills were right against our shores. But they had all started closing down. And Braddock was one of those towns that that kind of went fast and quick. And it's just as bad, if not worse. In fact, it's worse today than it was, you know, 43 years ago.
Interesting.
And 43 years ago, it was in decline. But, yeah. So, I mean, that you know, Pittsburgh and that time period, I think, speaks a lot to the background.
Normally, I think we divide up the podcast into three elements, but I think probably for the sake of today's conversation, because usually it's just a bunch of academics or us pretending to be academics talking about a movie, but because we have, you know, the actual titular character on here with us, we'll dispense a lot with the kind of three distinct parts and maybe take a more holistic approach to tackling the essential question. Hey, Nicole, what made you when you know, Mike posed the question, like working class horror, you know, something along those lines, what spoke to you so much about Martin, the concept of kind of working class horror?
Well, I think part of it is the setting. I mean, Braddock is almost another character in the film. And I know it's kind of like this cliche that we often talk about in films that have a very definite setting. But the whole atmosphere of decay in that town really resonated with me. And also, as I've rewatched it, there's some class division in that town. You have Cuda, and his family is more of a working class family, even though Cuda kind of has pretensions of, I think, being of a higher class with his fancy white suit and his little pin and his cravat and everything.
Right. I'd say that's because of tradition and his old world traditions that are no longer being paid attention to.
Right. Yeah, so that resonated with me. And then the other part that resonated with me is just how, you know, in traditionally we see a vampire as like this kind of decadent aristocrat, almost like a Marquis de Sade kind of character. If you look at some of the Hammer films, you know, the idea is that you have these corrupt aristocrats that are impious and they're doing all these things that are outside of the orthodoxy of the religion, and they're involved. And some of them, they're, you know, vampirism is kind of talked about as a cult. And here you have the would-be vampire is a grocery delivery boy, and the women who he's seeking out are usually upper middle class women, you know, where whose you know, husbands are on business trips and this kind of thing. And so it's an interesting, I think, inversion of that whole thing that is kind of interesting. It's, you know, the pretensions of something like in his dream sequences, you know, pretensions of something maybe a little bit more grandiose. And the reality is he's a grocery delivery boy.
Well, that's a pretty good observation of Martin's psychosis.
We've talked some about Braddock, and then our conversation turned to Cuda for a moment. Maybe let's stay there for a second, because it reminds me vaguely of our previous episode where we talked about the captive woman in the context of you know, the idea that there is a man that is more traditional, that is older, that maybe has seen his time come and go. What role does the youth of our main character, Martin, maybe have to do with that kind of old world mentality that what his great uncle, I think that's who he is, right? Is okay.
Well, it's his cousin, actually. But, you know, CUDA is a reference to the old world and superstition and religion and the absolute belief that comes with that kind of background. Martin is in that sense a kind of you know, rebel without a cause to CUDA's CUDA's old worldless.
No, I think it makes total sense, and I think so that tension between the two of them is important to make in the movie as interesting. That's cool.
Well, absolutely. I mean, Martin's whole point with CUDA is, look, it's not about superstition. Yeah. I don't fly. I don't turn into a bat. Garlic is not a problem and it's not a deterrent. A cross doesn't affect me. In other words, from Martin's own lips, there is no magic. And it's just that life is what it is. And Martin's trying to live his to the best he can, in spite of the fact that he has to stick to these old world superstitions. You know, if you're told you're something long enough, you start to believe it. So I think that has a lot to do with Martin's nature. He was born into this nonsense and was brainwashed into believing he was what they said
that,
he was.
That leaves me, this is kind of my final question, but I think it would be much better here. Is he actually a vampire, or is he just an unfortunate victim?
Well, he's both. He's a vampire only in the sense that he actually does draw blood and use it.
Okay.
But that's where it stops. As you know, as he explains to the disc jockey, which was Mike Gornick, by the way, who was a cinematographer as well. Martin explains to him that, you know, all of this superstition surrounding the powers of vampires is BS.
Yeah.
Martin's just trying to live day to day. Is he sick? Yeah, he's very sick. He's very sick. But he's also victimized by, you know, what his family has told him and what his family believes.
Yeah.
So he's between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah.
So I'd say, to boil it down, he's a crazy mixed up kid.
Playing him, was there like a dramaturgical like approach where you're, you know, getting into his head, or was, you know, Romero giving you some direction here? Can you talk some about that process?
Well, sure. I mean, the process for me is again, there is no magic in terms of acting. Everything comes off the page. So that's my job, to understand what George wrote. And then I have to find a way to express what George wrote, you know, physically and technically. And so I take everything and try to play it as I see it, as it comes off the page. Every scene is a new set of circumstances, has different risks, has different possibilities. And so you approach each scene and all of the work, you know, based on what the given circumstances are in the moment. First of all, we have to create a whole bunch of moments in order to create a movie. So that's really what it's all about. It's about, you know, no matter where you start, you have to start with whatever the specific circumstances are of that particular scene, why that scene is there, what that scene means, what these characters want, what these characters need, all of that kind of stuff kind of goes into it. But it's not as technical as I may be making it sound. It's about understanding and then incorporating that understanding into, you know, what you have to do in order to be an actor in front of a camera.
I have a question for John, if I can ask
it here.
Yeah. As I was watching the film again tonight, I was rewatching it. I mean, again, you know, your performance was just super, and just that kind of aloofness and to the character and the strangeness. And I'm wondering, like, on the set, were you, you know, how did this work on the set? Were you aloof from the other actors kind of in role, or what, were you able to turn it on and off?
Yes. Yeah, you turn it on and off. I do anyway. You know, when I'm in front of a camera, that's the work that has to be done. When I'm not in front of the camera, then I'm either studying for the next scene or working on a note that I have to accomplish or looking at something else or having lunch. As I said, it's really kind of what I get from the page. And then, yeah, I get direction from George every now and then. Although he didn't do a lot of verbal direction. We shot a lot of film, though. So George always knows what he wants when he goes into working on a scene. And he has a way of helping everybody, get to it. And make it make it work. Did I answer your question, Nicole?
You sure did. I just find it remarkable that you can turn it on and off so quickly. That's just another layer of skill involved.
I think most actors do. I think you turn it on and off. I mean, you hear about these people that stay in character forever. You know, if that works for them, if that's what they need to do, then cool. But it's not a process. I was trained in the theater. So, what I know how to do is I know how to learn the lines, learn to communicate, learn to, be able to, communicate with the other people on stage, understand the scene, and go from there. It doesn't take a lot of me walking around in Martin's shoes.
Interesting and valuable to, you know, theater kids that, So Mike, we have one of our talking points here for this episode to talk some about, a Marxian approach to vampires. I thought we would, maybe take a moment and think about Braddock, right? That's the name of the town.
Holy moly.
In terms of capitalism moving into an area and sucking the lifeblood out of it and then leaving it for, you know, leaving it for dead, right? Which is essentially.
Well, yeah, I mean, capitalism didn't even come near Braddock. It was its lack of capitalism that left Braddock for dead. It was not resurrected, still has not been resurrected. And I don't know that it's in anybody's plan.
Yeah,
to
I think one of the really interesting things that I've kind of run into in my reading kind of lately about the kind of deindustrialization that's been going on in the United States is that There's this feeling among economists that that free flows of capital are good, and the faster we can let that capital flow, the better. And that one of the things that we've kind of started to learn recently, which we probably should have learned in the 70s and the 80s is that capital can move very quickly, but people can't. And that laborers can't move as workers can't move as quickly, especially, you know, because you have ties, you have a house, you have family.
We certainly can't move from one industry, say steel or coal, into another industry, say in the broader, let's say the world of computers. And what that's doing, and the businesses that have come up out of Silicon Valley and other places, So
no, I think
that's my two cents. Anyway, I don't.
Oh yeah, no, exactly. So in kind of looking at it, it's less of. I guess the capitalist going around to places that have already been created and sucking everything out of them, and more like just leaving them and just letting them kind of wither when something better comes along.
Yes, that's exactly what I think has happened over the course of the last, you know, close to 50 years in the United States. Is that, see, we're not manufacturers anymore. We don't do that. We move from agriculture to industrial revolution, and we became manufacturers, and we had plenty of jobs as manufacturers, and a lot of companies and the like, and there's a new kind of manufacturing that doesn't have anything to do with metal or coal or any of the old kinds of, you know, building that we used to do.
Yeah.
I'm just rambling on here, folks.
No, you're doing great.
Tell me to be quiet.
No. We want to hear from you. I think that does beg the question, and maybe Nicole can help us out here. What do you think then? Why is this ground, this world? Because I feel like these are tensions we see a lot in horror film, not just from the 1960s and the 70s, but I think we've seen them in the post-recession era as well. Why is this ground, do you think, so ripe for horror? Why is this such a great setting for horror novels or horror movies, Nicole? What do you think?
Oh.
Yeah, I don't know, you know, why in general. I know just in my work, like, you know, I this is where I am, right? I live in southeastern Indiana, and in a blue collar neighborhood. Yeah. And my husband works at a blue collar job, and my dad worked at a blue collar job. And so this is kind of the world I inhabit. So when it comes time to write, I just, you know, it's not like I'm necessarily setting out to depict a certain kind of thing. I just made a decision pretty early on in my writing career that I was going to write about the world around me and not try to write about people in New York or LA or whatever, because I don't know about that. So for me, it's just kind of like what I see. But I think in general, you know, they're like setting can provide a certain atmosphere, a certain tone, to a work of fiction or a film. And I think if there's an undercurrent of despair, you know, I mean, in Martin, you have the Braddock, you see Braddock when you come off the train from Pittsburgh, and then you have that wonderful score, the music of the film, evoking in this very, very gentle sort of, pitying way or emotive, kind of sad, grieving kind of way, this town that is not what it could be. So I think that definitely it works as a tone. It works as a, you know, I mean, and there's something creepy about a place that used to be thriving and isn't anymore, whether it's an old abandoned amusement park or whether it's an old abandoned factory. You know, if there's a place that used to be productive and now it's not, there's something instinctively that we recoil from.
I think one of the reasons that Nicole, you get it so right in your work is that it just feels sincere, right? It doesn't feel like somebody that has decided, oh, this is where it would be most symbolic or to set the story, or here's two characters and one of them's going to represent this and the other one's going to it just feels like it's sincere, like you know these people, and they're people that I've known too. Like the one that I just can't stop thinking about is the Sadist Bible, where you have two wildly different characters from mm-hmm. Two different kind of classes within exurbs or, you know, the rural America. And it just works, I think, because it just feels mm-hmm. sincere.
Well, thank you. That's the goal, is not to, I mean, if I go into writing a piece of fiction with that affectation at the start, then that's not a good sign. It doesn't bode well if I go into it not being sincere, in my opinion. And that's just how I've always worked. And I think, you know, taking it back to Martin for a second too, it's like, I don't know the details about George Romero's upbringing. Maybe this is something that John could, you know, enlighten us about. But I would imagine that his upbringing was pretty, that George Romero's upbringing was pretty blue collar as well, because I think he was just filming what he saw. You know, there's a real blue collar feel to a lot of Romero films. And I don't think it's because he was going slumming, you know, or...
Yeah.
You know, I don't think it's because he decided that this was, you know, a fashionable thing to do. I think it was just he kept it. He's from Pittsburgh, and he was, you know, looking at his surroundings and decided that he could make films in Western Pennsylvania that he didn't have to go.
Well,
to
he is he's actually from the Bronx, and went to he went to college here. He went to. At the time, they used to call it Carnegie Tech, but it was CMU. And it's for mm-hmm. he went for fine arts.
Okay,
he's a tremendous mm. he's a tremendous write he's a tremendous artist. He writes and I mean he paints and draws, or painted and drew, dropped out of school. Him and a bunch of other guys got together, and that's how Night of the Living Dead came to be, is Group 10, or I think Image 10, something like that.
Was his background more upper middle class? Or was it working
that
class?
I couldn't say. I've never known a lot about George's early days. I don't think he was, you know, I think his family was okay. I think he was able to, I'm not going to speak to, you know, his family's worth or anything like that.
Sure.
Because I don't know it.
Yeah. But
but his work in Pittsburgh is really where it all began after he dropped out of Carnegie Mellon.
Yeah.
And he and Russ Striner and Gary Striner and John Russo and a whole bunch of other guys, about 10 of them, got together and had this idea of Night of the Living Dead. So George and John Russo worked on the text, and they put a production company together. And in 1968, they shot Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's important to – we've talked a lot about setting, and I think probably what this episode is highlighting best is how well Romero uses – those settings to tell different messages, right? Like there's the farmhouse in Night of the Living Dead. There's clearly the kind of downtrodden exurbs of, you know, where we are in Martin. And in, you know, like Dawn of the Dead, there is the mall, which I think is a very middle class setting. So I think he's really focused on that plight of that middle class, that working class mentality.
Yeah, I agree. I think you can find that in most of his films. Absolutely. I think any good film has social commentary and hopefully points out some of our more important issues with how to live our lives.
So one of the last things I kind of have down that I wanted to talk about, there is a sexual nature of Martin's violence that I think is unavoidable in this film. And I found it both intriguing, but also like you can forgive a lot because of his upbringing and, you know, what happens to him. But there's some pretty devastating imagery that this film uses.
Oh, yeah.
So I wanted it open up to the panel to.
there's no doubt Martin is a serial killer. He doesn't live within the standards of the law. There's no doubt about that. I mean, the real irony of the film is that he is warned by Cuda when he first arrives, don't touch anyone in the city. Don't touch anyone in the neighborhood. And what happens? The woman that he never touches, that he falls in love with, is the one that ends up committing suicide and the person he gets, he is staked for.
Yeah. Well, and especially when you juxtapose that with that opening scene, you know, with the opening montage on the, I guess. On the
yeah. Panel. Well, you can see Martin has quite an imagination as to where he thinks he is and to where he actually is.
Yeah.
One of the things that I found interesting about this dimension of the film is if you contrast it with other disturbing scenes and kind of the transgressive 70s horror films, there's lots of sexual violence, but you know, it's a different kind of sexual violence than the sexual violence of, say, Last House on the Left, where that's very loud and very brash.
Martin is not a slasher movie. There's only 90 seconds maybe of blood in the whole movie, but when it's used to its greatest effect.
And so much of it is also the effect is what, you know, the lead up to it, like the whole tension and the suspense and also just, you know, kind of like the moodiness, the emotions that wash over your face, John, as you're portraying Martin, you know, and all the complicated emotions of loneliness and lust and alienation and meekness, but also, guts. I mean, what he does is, you know, has a certain variety of almost bravery. I hate to say it because bravery is kind of a positive term, but maybe gumption.
There you go.
On one hand, he's portraying himself as being somebody who's hearing impaired and very humble and a beggar. And then in very shortly afterwards, he is very masterful and very... manipulative and shrewd. And so, you know, it's a very multifaceted portrayal. And, you know, I like Last House on the Left. Mm-hmm. I think it's not necessarily, I think it kind of accidentally stumbles onto portraying certain qualities of trauma that are accurate. And especially portraying sadism, which is an unfortunate thing, but it exists. And so just telling the truth about that, where I think with Martin, it's a different kind of violence because it's not sadistic. And it's not loud and brash. It's not the violence of somebody who is really confident, or fully confident in himself. It's the violence of somebody who is, you know, in some ways kind of uncertain or has at least a split personality where he's this combination of confidence and meekness that I find fascinating.
I don't think those descriptions of Martin are I think they all come together as one.
Right. Yeah. And that's, there are contrasts and then it, can you talk about that a little bit about how they come together?
Well, I think, repeat to me the terms that you used.
Oh, it kind of like, you know, he's both meek and he's shrewd, you know, meek and kind of brave. He's you know, kind of masterful, but also, you know, it's kind of like
I think he's all of those things. Because he is psychotic or worse, perhaps, although I can't imagine what could be, it doesn't take away from his intelligence, not to say he's book learned. He has street smarts. He knows what Martin is doing through this whole film is trying to survive.
Yeah. Man.
He's working his way towards survival. How do I live in this world? How can I connect with a woman who does that? As I said, which leads to his biggest downfall.
Right. And I can definitely see that. Yeah, I didn't see it as like
even when he goes in for the kill. Especially with the two women, the woman on the train, Fran Middleton, and Sarah Venable, who's the woman in the house. His attempt to have them is actually pretty. What's the word? Clean. His approach is not necessarily to hurt, cause hurt. His approach is about, you know, trying to feed his adolescent genes. if that's what he is, an adolescent.
that's really interesting because I kind of thought that, you know, Romero really kind of invented the zombie genre.
Oh, no doubt.
He wasn't the first person to make a movie about zombies, to make the modern zombie movie, he was the first.
He also doesn't call them zombies. Right. He never called them zombies.
It's true. That's true. I think to Martin and you kind of think, oh well, it's just a vampire movie, but really, I'm trying to think of a vampire movie.
It's not a vampire movie. For me, anyway, it's not a vampire. Yes, I mean, it's subject matter at the root, I guess, is vampire. But
that idea that he's just surviving.
It's really a character piece about, you know, a disturbed individual. That's what
I just think about the idea that he's just surviving.
Yeah.
Right. And after that, kind of in the 80s, we start to get a vein of vampire movies where they're not high class vampires. They're not, you know, trying to take over the world. They're not all powerful. They're just trying to, and I'm thinking about like the Lost Boys. Interview with the Vampire.
Aristocratic.
Probably too. Where they're, you know, so.
Well, and to draw the discussion, you know, up with a nice little bow here, the idea that, yes, he's an awful person that does awful things, but you can boil his character down into a character that is merely trying to survive, I think is a great way to evaluate this kind of exurb rural area that sometimes votes against its own survival, that, you know, is reactionary. Some may say racist, you know, whatever. There are lots of derogatory things that sometimes people in the city say about it when, gosh, if it looks like the suburb like Braddock, dude, people are just trying to survive and they might be, you know, doing dumb and awful and despicable things, but they're just,
correct.
Well, I think that pretty much wraps up our conversation. Nicole or Mike, do you have any or John, for that matter, anything left to say?
Nicole, you must have something.
Well, one last closing thing is I think that the multifaceted nature, I think you're right that it's not a conflict in the character. It really is, different facets of the diamond. And I just don't know of any other character in horror film that is quite so complicated.
Yeah.
And I really want to affirm that and say that if you have not seen Martin, go and get it. Has there not been a new version of the film released? I thought it was like
there's one supposedly coming out. It was supposed to come out this fall, a UK version. In fact, I did some extra stuff for its release. Me and Mike Gornick and a couple other people walked around Braddock and went to some of the locations, which many, 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 many are now gone, it's 43 years ago.
Yes, but go and watch Martin, people. Go and see it. If you haven't seen it, switch.
And come down next weekend, Strongville, Ohio. Yeah. Take a road trip. Cinema Wasteland.
I would imagine Strongville is... probably not entirely dissimilar to a gazillion other working class smaller towns, even like Kansas City.
I would bet you're right.
You know, it's really interesting that that somebody from the UK would be really interested in Martin, because the UK was banned. It was one of the original video nasties.
Well, not anymore. I have friends that run a convention in the UK in Manchester. They're going on their fourth or fifth convention this coming, the end of November, early March of 2020. I met the couple that run it in Germany about 8 years ago. But they started this all Romero convention.
That's right.
In other words, all of us that come are Romero people. So from the list of movies and people that populated those films, there is an all Romero convention in the UK, and it's brilliant. It's great.
Yeah, we'll have to get there.
I love to go there.
Yeah. Well, are there any other things that you would like to plug, John, before we move on and talk about what next episode is going to be about?
Oh, gosh, golly. I think I'm okay. I think given you everything I can give you. I'm sure we'll think of a litany of things.
Well, we'll totally include him in the show notes then. How about Nicole?
Please.
Do you go ahead and promote away, if you would?
Well, other than the books, which I've already mentioned, I am teaching horror writing classes on Patreon using distance learning kind of video instruction kind of thing. So there are, as of now, 6 classes posted, a new one posted every month, and it's just $15 a month. So it's good instruction for an inexpensive price. So go ahead and check out patreon.com/Nicole Cushing. That's NicoleCushing. There is no H in Nicole, which some people want to do. And I'll actually be appearing the second weekend of October at a great convention here in Louisville, Kentucky called Imaginarium, where I'll be appearing on panels talking about the craft of writing. That's a great convention. I'm happy to be appearing
there.
That's
awesome. How about Mike? Where can they find more of your stuff out there?
You can find more of my stuff at signalhorizon.com. That dingy little
working class area,
cave corner of the internet that I run with my buddy Tyler.
I like that. I'm gonna change the name. I like it. Very good. Well, you could find more of my stuff at Ty Unsel on Twitter, or check out Mike and I's Facebook group, where we talk about the horror podcast and all kinds of new takes and smart takes on horror movies. Next week, we will have Paul Tremblay talking about the movie Take Shelter and his concepts of ambiguity. Until then, class dismissed.